also want to invite our audience to just take a moment away from maybe busy lives and worries and duties and just arrive here with us in this moment, coming together in a space where we have this common interest in consciousness, in exploring about, going deeper, and also in serving, being in service for others, for our planet. And I want to just invite you to connect to this large group and energy field. And today I'm honored, excited, and joyful that I'm able to welcome Terry Patten to the Conscious Evolution Summit.
Thank you for having me, Priya. I'm happy to be here with you.
Yeah. And Terry, I just want to really directly jump into the topic, which is, I guess, now very alive in your life, your new book, what you wrote, The New Republic of the Heart. And I participated in some videos and webinars you gave, and I'm very excited about it. And to start with, I'm very interested in what motivated you writing this book.
Well, Priya, I think that there are many different ways that human beings can wake up, and that we are all waking up, but not only in, we don't always mean the same thing. I was raised in an intentional community, a cooperative community that was founded by members of a Christian church that comes from the German Anabaptist church, the Peace Church in America, where members of the church do things other than fight. In if they're drafted into the army, they are nonviolent. And they bought a 70-acre cornfield, and they wanted to live with about 70 families. And pretty soon, and to cooperatively own their land, and pretty soon some African-American and Jewish and other people that weren't mixing, this is in the late 1940s, applied for membership, and they decided to live together with people of other races and religions as a witness for peace and brotherhood. So I grew up in the 1960s, mentored by aunts and uncles in this community who were dedicated to social, taking a social stance for peace and for brotherhood. And so it was a social activism. So I very much was raised in the civil rights movement and the peace movement. And that really was the focus of my interest in my teen years and early years of college. And I participated in many protests and led some and organized and created publications and, you know, was an activist. But then I realized that the revolution really had to begin with me, and that I was too immature to create a better world, that I had to give myself over to profound transformation of my own being. And that drew me to the Human Potential Movement, which was just getting started in the early 70s. And I came out to California, and pretty soon I found my way, it's a longer story, but I found my way to an ashram where I committed myself to intense spiritual practice. And I spent 15 years of pretty much immersed and committed to making every moment of my day a spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. I, not just meditating, but serving and feeling and breathing and regarding diet and regarding sexuality and relationships and friendships and work, all as spiritual practices. So I began then later to feel that there were ways that I felt confined in that environment. I left the ashram and I started a company called Tools for Exploration that sold technologies for altering consciousness, everything from electroencephalographic machines that could connect to a home computer to audio recordings that could change your consciousness to subtle energy tools, a whole variety of things. And I built that company up and sold it. And when I did, I was feeling the first intuitions of what we now see before us fully, which is the whole human species is being confronted with a sudden recognition that we could destroy ourselves and that if we don't change, we will. And that is a shock. I had some intuitions of this beginning to arise in the late 90s. And then as soon as I sold my company in 1998, I just fully poured myself into researching and paying attention to this. And that drew me into, well, just tremendous amount of reading and researching. And I wrote a version of a book that wasn't, it had a lot of insight in it, but it wasn't all that it needed to be to really be of help in all the ways I wanted it to be. But I showed it to Ken Wilber, who at the time I was regarding as the most brilliant single, you know, intelligence I was aware of in the world. Mm. And Ken invited me to help him create integral life practice. And I taught many seminars then in the years of the 2000s with Diane Hamilton and Jeff Salzman and many good people, many others, Hui Lam, many dear friends, and then wrote with Ken and Marco Morelli and Adam Leonard, Integral Life Practice, the book on how to live an integral life. Because I'd been a practitioner longer than my other co-authors are younger men, and so I was kind of the experienced voice that created that book. And since then, I've taught integral practice. And I always taught practice as being not just personal. In the integral theory, there are four quadrants. The interior of your individual life, the exterior, the interior of our collective life, and our systems that we live in. And I could see that every aspect of human existence was hurtling toward a collision with the healthy limits of our mother planet's capacity to endure our impacts. And that there was a real disconnect because people were awakening to their interior potentials, but they weren't understanding that as a catalyst for a kind of leadership that would create a social change. And I could see that that was absolutely inherently something that had to happen if higher consciousness could guide our way forward. So I think it was about 7 or 8 years ago, I began conducting a teleseminar series. It was not video, just audio, called Beyond Awakening. And in my Beyond Awakening dialogues, I dialogued with people from, you know, Ram Dass and Adya Shanti and Gangaji, very spiritual, to evolutionary scientists, you know, variety of thought leaders. And I asked one question: how could a transformation of human consciousness help us to meet our existential challenges? Mm-hmm. And I thought that was the most important question that we all needed to answer. And so that helped me integrate and come into a whole set of new understandings. I felt that the wisdom of spirituality was absolutely essential to our survival as a species.
What answers did you receive, Terry?
Oh, well, we had 115 conversations in that series, so I received
maybe a summary
answers.
Or what you now, with your experience now, what is most relevant in your perspective?
I think that, you know, one of the eternal truths of spirituality is that life is a school, and that every moment is an opportunity to awaken, to grow, to love, and also that there's no difference between our own awakening and self-actualization, our flowering as an individual, and our being of benefit, our learning to be effectively of benefit. Just being a nice person is good, but our species faces much more fundamental and very challenging conditions. And if we understand the implications of the spiritual path, the 10th ox herding picture in Buddhism, or the Bodhisattva vow, you know, we, in a way, you become freer and happier and more balanced and more, you know, it's like as you grow, you become a more and more like the Buddha, more and more. But I think you get to a place where you begin to inherit a responsibility for all the problems of the world. And that's what they sometimes call dark night of the soul. But you begin to have the weight of the world on your shoulders. Mm. Because there are so many people in denial, even of global warming. So many people in denial of our desecration of our mother planet. So how is it that we can be true to the inherently joyful and beautiful and undiminished, you know, the mystery of existence is a glory without end and with, you know, of infinite depth. Mm. And to not be enjoying the divine nature of each breath is, you know, let's not lose that.
And yet
somehow we have to be doing that, not as if, oh, well, that's all I have to do. No, you also, everything you love, your own children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, or those, the great, you know, if you don't have children, all the children and grandchildren of the future, not just the human ones, but all the creatures and all the plants, they all depend on what human beings will be doing in your lifetime. The whole future of it is, and to be recognizing that there's another side of spirituality. It's not just awakening into transcendental freedom. It's also discovering the reason that you were born. And not just recognizing, but becoming the hands and feet of that mystery, so that you give a unique gift that has your genius expressed in it. But in this moment, every one of us has together been given a challenge that, well, that many intelligent people think, you know, many, many, many intelligent people have come to the conclusion that we are now finally seeing that the whole experiment of human civilization is a self-terminating matter, and that the world won't really, the human civilization, the world will go be fine, but the human civilization will come to an end in the course of the next century or two. And in all probability, human civilization will take with it most of the people on the planet, if not all. And probably the ability of the planet to be a benign place where most of the creatures could also survive. So this, I don't think people really know. One of the big points of my book is the future is emergent. It is alive. No one knows what will happen, and we are going to co-create it, and we are co-creating it now. And therefore, we don't have enough information. We don't have enough certainty to be pessimistic. If we think we know it's all lost, we risk creating what we think will happen, and that would be a moral failure. So we're tasked with really not knowing what will. The future is unknowable. And we are asked to become the kinds of people who could transform the whole system. Not just ourselves and our behavior, but our friendships, the way we love each other, the way a man loves a woman in a straight relationship, or any loving relationship, gay or straight, however. The way we know how to be people is good, but it needs to go up a level. The way we know how to be a friend to another person is good. And now it has to become something amazingly new and different. The way we can come together as practitioners and practice together, that's a good thing. It's hard. But that has to break through to a whole new realm. And the way that we bring our spirituality into our social responsibility and our politics, that has to break through to something entirely new. And therefore, this adventure of practice is, all the conditions are set up for us to open into radical growth. Mm-hmm. However enlightened you may be, hope that you're enlightened enough to be a tiny baby in a whole new arc of maturation that will take you somewhere you can't imagine, because that's what's asked of us now. And understanding that and being able to be compassionate to ourselves and really able to dig deep and bring our very best. It tends to be that people live a very narrow band of what is possible for human beings. And when we break out of that a little bit and we become to some degree spiritually awakened, we feel like, I have now awakened, I've transformed things. And then we realize, my spirituality also implies a social commitment. Now I've awakened in another way. Well, those are really important, and they're a big point in my book, but we also have to awaken, you know, the we. Like mm-hmm. there's you here, there's me here. Midway between our eyes, there's mm-hmm. something else. That's you and me. You, there's the you and me of this moment. Mm-hmm. And the you and me of this moment is good. But we're now poised and asked for it to become something amazing, something it's never been before in the whole history of human beings. Mm. Evolutionary theory and game theory imply that the next stage for us would be a human superorganism. Mm. Now, anybody who's tried to create a community know how hard it is. It's hard for one man and one woman to get along. And it's harder if there's then one child. And it's harder still, you know, you expand it out. You put in another man and a woman and another child or four or five more children. You just two families living together. And it's overwhelming. Oh, how can you make it all work? And yet we're going to have to find a way to resort to love and to have our love give us a new level of efficiency that breaks through to a whole new level. You know, there the likelihood, according to climate science, is that large sections of the Earth are going to become uninhabitable. And hundreds of millions, even maybe billions of people are going to have to leave where they live, and it's going to create mayhem, horrible. The political response to the migration that we've already had has been extreme, and that's 1% of what's coming. All of that is very, very sobering, and so we don't want to face it. And so there's a subtext underneath all our conversations about the future, which is that we're afraid. We're afraid. Of course we're afraid. It's scary.
Yeah.
And then we see that that when we're afraid, we tighten up and we don't want to be that way. So we say, well, no, I'm going to choose hope. I am going to turn to the good. Which is beautiful. I agree. Let's do that. But it's not a simple this or that. There's a kind of positivity that we're tending to cling to that doesn't have the depth to face the darkness. And that's not enough. And if we do dare to face the darkness, that takes so much from us that people tend to arrive exhausted, just having had the courage to face that the world may end, so to speak. They kind of fall exhausted thinking that's true. This is not a accurate percentages, but it's true in a general sense. 90% of human beings are in total denial of our actual situation. And of the rest, 90% are sure that the end is near and there's no hope. And so there's only a few of us who recognize that actually life itself so wants to live. And the whole history of evolution has been emergence, 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 emergence. That means miracle, 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 miracle. And we would come to this moment with cultural evolution having created all of these miracles, and then suddenly no miracles. Only the hard facts of physics are going to just flatten us. Well, I think we're living at the beginning of an age of miracles. But they're going to have to come into this world through our hearts, through our love, through our present moment waking up and breaking through and forgiving ourselves and each other for all our imperfections. And saying, I need you. I can't respond to the most important thing in my life without your help. Be with me in this. Please be the best version of yourself. Find a deeper intelligence and a deeper love. Be amazing. There's a greatness asked of us now. We were born in this time. Well, our soul said yes. So you and I and anyone hearing these words somehow said yes to being here at this time. When everything we love is threatened, but in which everything that is beautiful has the potential to blossom in new ways, and it needs to come into the world through the behavior and the intelligence of human beings. Can we, as individuals, but also as friends, create a conduit through which that divine activity, that evolutionary impulse, can come into this human world and change everything? Let's hold that to our hearts. And let's let it transform us. That's how I understand it. That's what my book is about. That's what, and why I call it A New Republic of the Heart, is because I think when we begin to realize that the old game is over, the whole way we have known how to be human and how to be spiritual and how to be activists and how to be experts and how to do it is bankrupt. Some part of us begins to say, oh, I want to be a part of the goodness that, you know, even if what is ahead in my life is nothing but death and destruction, if my future is a great hospice project, keeping my heart open in hell, if that's, even if I want to be doing the same thing that I would do if we were going to turn it all around. Becoming a new kind of human being, capable of a different kind of love, beginning to, like, this whole human experiment wants to give birth to something that goes beyond what we've been before. And that is still what would be needed to hold the dying body if it all falls away. We need a new kind of adult man and an adult woman who is mature. Who is willing to hold the whole suffering heart of life, not just humanity, but all life, with care, and be joyously, fiercely here to do what needs to be done. We take up residence in a whole new nation. That's why I call it A New Republic of the Heart. Back before the Cuban Revolution, Fidel and Che Guevara, and that band of revolutionaries, they declared Cuba Libre. They went to the mountains and they declared a new nation. Well, inherent, life wants to keep living. Evolution wants to keep evolving. And that part of us is already, without my ever having written the book, it would be true anyway, we are already beginning to live in a new possibility. That's what I mean by a new republic of the heart. So the subtitle is An Ethos for Revolutionaries. Hmm. I think that in this time, we're in a crisis of fragmentation. Everything's going faster and faster and more complex to the point that it's ready to shake us apart. To be wholeness itself, to just keep choosing wholeness, to be a presence of wholeness, to be a presence of love, to be a presence of sanity, to be a presence of integrity, to be a coherent presence while we're all being shaken apart. That's the true spirit of revolution now.
In a way, really stabilizing and really being our biggest values in a way.
Discovering a whole new level of it all. Mm. Yeah. How does that feel? I talked a lot. I want to give you a chance to speak.
I mean, for me, what I got is that we need to be kind of able to really experience the tension between the pain and the hope, or the facts and the actuality, and where we connect to a kind of hope, which is really difficult to articulate. It's in the invisible. But I sense it in myself, but I couldn't bring really images or ideas, because it's such a vague internal feeling. I often ask myself when I look out there, or when I read a newspaper or watch the news, how can it come that there is still joy and hope and even excitement? Because I remember, Terry, when I was born, I had the feeling so much is not really working. The world I'm in, is something is really massively wrong. And this kind of stayed with me until my adult life. And so that there is this chance that there is of many opportunities, that really fundamental changes can appear. This is something I'm looking for it my whole life in a way. So this branch of I want to really be part of something emerging new, where I don't know what it is and how it looks like, is in myself. It's much stronger than the fear or the devastation or the despair. It's there. I can connect to it. But the other, which is kind of pulling me, calling me towards something I don't know, is so strong. Yes. And when I hear about a crisis, I mean, my partner just shared this crisis in California on the coast with this red algaes, where many...
It's in Florida.
In Florida, where
I live in California,
where a lot of sea life is dying, and my reaction was:
we have fires here. They have red tide there. We have disasters. This is the time of plagues already.
Yeah,
we live in the time of the plagues.
But Terry, the funny thing was, or the surprising thing, my reaction was good. Hopefully that wakes people up and shows them that something deeply isn't working. Thank you, nature, that you sacrifice in a way yourself to really shake us. So
I really appreciate that. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, I feel the same way. You know, I love this word you have in German for contemporary, as the word we use in English, Zeitgenossen.
Yeah.
We're Genossen in this Zeit.
Yeah.
We're comrades.
Yeah.
Our souls are the souls that said, okay, I will be here when the crisis is hitting its intense point. I will be here, you know, in evolutionary theory, they sometimes talk about punctuated equilibrium, that the fossil record doesn't seem to change very much for millions of years, and then in a few 100,000 years, suddenly everything gets very different. There's this period of rapid change. Maybe there were asteroids hitting the Earth, or maybe there were volcanic eruptions. Who knows what it was, but somehow everything changed. Well, we are now going to actually be alive during the first part of a great tipping point in the whole trajectory of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And we were raised in the tail end of an era of tremendous prosperity and stability and comfort and ease. And we have access to all the world's information and the internet and the wisdom traditions of everyone who's ever lived in all cultures. And they're all in communication and in conversation with science and rationality. It's an amazing time of privilege, and we can all travel, and you could visit me, I could visit you. Everything is, it's an age of miracles. And we are seeing our image in the mirror, and it is as if there were 8 billion maggots devouring the life of the planet, and we are one of them. And we see ourselves, and we can't stop.
It's like cancer.
We're in the middle of doing it, and we can't stop. Ah. We're destroying everything we love, and we can't stop doing it. We can't stop doing the things. It's our middle-class lives that are overburdening everything.
Hmm.
So we have to be deeper on the, like you said, in the pain and the grief and the fear and the darkness, but we also have to be deeper in the joy and the wonder and the amazement and the freedom. Both. We have to be deeper beings.
And I feel this. We really need to expand. I always get expand. To hold both, to be able to really hold both.
Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, there are really, I really want to also encourage people that it's not always necessary that you need to build up a huge company or be, write books or give seminars. I did so many tiny steps in my personal life in the last 20 years where I reduced my ecological footprint dramatically. And it really came from feeling the pain. Many things I couldn't do anymore. For example, I loved going skiing. I went skiing since my childhood for almost 30 years. And one day when I was waiting on a lift to climb up the mountain, not climb up, but be carried with this machine, and I smelled the air from the smog of this machine, and I saw this crowd of people there, and I saw the parking lot full of cars, and there was a second, and I said, it was clear, I never can do that again. I can't contribute anymore to destroying these mountains, to destroy our clear air. I can't contribute anymore. And from this moment on, I never went skiing again. I mean, I go for walks in snow and I go to the mountains, but without using any machines. And this is just a little example. Or I moved from a huge, big house with many rooms to a much more simplified life. I now live since 6 years in a yurt. There is a tiny house next to me with a kitchen, a bathroom, and it's enough. I don't need anything more. And I guess when we really, as you said, you said again and again that really awaken to our deep nature and connecting to this joy and this wonder which is there, I don't need a lot material stuff out there. I feel so full and nourished and abundant in myself that things, I don't need things to add to that.
That's beautiful.
So just
and yet you one of the things that I think is so important is that we do celebrate the joyful aspects of how we, in a sense, have already awakened and are living in a truer way, like you are describing. But it's so important that you stay feeling not the negative pressure, the positive pressure, the exciting, inspiring pressure, that however beautiful your life now already is, more is asked and possible and necessary. And so all of whatever clarity and health and beauty your life has already achieved is the beginning point now for you, perhaps, you know, our souls have to go into new territory. You know, this pioneering souls idea that Barbara Mark Zuber always talks about. Mm. Well, if we're to really be pioneering souls, we have to be getting out of our own comfort zone as a practice.
Yeah.
And the more joyous and clear and the more our lives are really working and the more inherent pleasure we're feeling in all of our being, that's the foundation. In a sense, it's like, really is like the hero's journey. We together, humanity, we are the hero who of a story, and we're at the beginning, you know, we're being in the beginning of the hero's journey, as it was described by Joseph Campbell. The first thing that happens is the hero is given a call to go on their heroic journey. The first thing that they do is say, no, 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 I don't want to do that. They refuse.
But something will kick you.
That's right. That's what happens. So we should take some comfort in the fact that that's the inherent nature of the hero's journey. So see, we're right on schedule. We're refusing the call. So we're at right at the beginning of our hero's journey. As humanity, we are refusing our call. And then, you know, if you break it down, it has many pieces. You meet the mentor. You get an intuition of who you truly are. You pass tests. You get talismans and magic powers.
You almost die.
And you discover that you have to meet your nemesis. So our nemesis is, you know, there's this famous, I don't know if it's so well known among German-speaking people, but it's sort of a joke in English. We have met the enemy and he is us. So that's our nemesis. You know, our hero's journey is a battle with our own, the limited ways of being ourselves that are still powerful. I use the word revolution in the title on purpose, even though I'm very much an evolutionary thinker. this phrase, the integral revolution. An integral revolution is in every part and it's in the whole. That means that the leading edge of evolution is struggling right now in your heart and in my heart and in the heart of every other person. And it's always, because this is such a massive fundamental shift that's being asked, we are all now called. Every organization, every family, every friendship, every piece, every shred, like a fractal, every region, every tribe, every, you know, it has to happen among the German-speaking people. All together. And so it has soul qualities. We have collective traumas. We have collective shadows. We have collective greatness. We have collective souls. Mm-hmm. We have collective heroism. We have collective sainthood. We have collective destiny. Mm-hmm. And we have, as individuals, to become so fully ourselves that we, each of us, is a leader of this. It can't have one leader or five leaders. It needs the whole body of life, the whole body politic. We use that term in English, the body politic. The revolution has to be in every cell of the body politic.
You bring that so beautifully. The image I get with your passion and you naming all of that is really like an earthquake shaking the whole planet.
Well, you know, yes, except that's true. But that image makes me wince a little bit, because another thing I like to talk about is that for us in this time, the political issue is not whether there will be radical change or not. We're trying to bring about radical change. No, we don't have to bring it about. It's going to happen to us whether we like it or not. The political issue is, how harsh will the change be? Mm. How violent? How destructive? Mm. How gentle? How life-affirming? Mm. How positive? How creative can it be? Mm. That's our issue. I had to form a little company to do my work almost 20 years ago, and I named it Soft Landing Enterprises because that's the political issue I knew, to soften our transitions, to have a soft landing, not a harsh landing, again and again and again.
Mm. Yeah, I resonate a lot with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, I mean, I'm very much a visual person, and really in the sensing and feeling mode, there comes also this image with when the earth is shaken and volcanic energy is there and the lava comes out. It also brings, makes the land fertile as well. So. Yeah.
Yes.
And how can we support that? How can we really support this turmoil energy and all the struggle and change to support, as you said, the soft landing? I like that image a lot. Yeah. Wow.
You know, I can feel a great deal of purity and intensity in your commitment and in your your way of being with all this. And I want to honor that, and I want to... I hope that all of this conversation only empowers and blesses you. Sometimes when I talk with groups, I have to begin the conversation by metaphorically hitting everybody over the head with a stick, you know, to break them out of their denial. You know, they think the biggest issues in the world are keeping the economy growing, or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. People are you know, that they need that wake up call.
Yeah.
But I think we need to notice that God is looking back at us through these eyes mm-hmm. that are beholding us. And God is only needing to be noticed to come forward even more powerfully.
Mm-hmm.
And if the God that is alive and that is beating our hearts is fully allowed to do God's work, then everywhere we go, that divinity gets magnified, and that strength of character and that sense of destiny gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And our contact, you know, you and I never met until an hour ago. But you're my sister in this work, and I need you, and I love you, and I need your love. That's how it has to be.
Yeah. And when I listen to you, Terry, in that, I really also get this sense of a totally new game and forms are created. It's, yeah. Really, yeah. And this being with this not knowing and being daring to be surprised and daring to just follow impulses and see what is the next and what is the next without knowing.
Yeah. That's the way life has done it right from the beginning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's how every miracle in the history of evolution has felt like this. We don't know, and yet we will. We don't know, and yet we are. We don't know, and yet we love. That's and that's the good thing. I mean, we have a, you know, we're waking up from a lot of problems about our relationship to our sexuality. But, you know, Plato and Ken Wilber and many others use this word eros to talk about the fundamental urge of evolution. And it is something like that sexual desire in your loins, kind of, you know, yes, I want, you know, like, well, you know, I want my life force to flow into this world. I want my love to make a difference. I want to, you know, in the sense that it's, I'm sure it's a little different, masculine and feminine sexuality moves differently, but it's like, I want to impregnate the world with more love. You know, I want it to bear that fruit more fully. Mm-hmm. And when we feel that and we delight in that, so that it is like, you know, we take pleasure and we feel fed and we feel happy, we feel seen and we feel loved, just like you do in sexuality. If our evolutionary friendships have that quality more and more, then our simpler lives that consume less from the planet, you know, the more joy that we find in our living, the less we need to console unhappiness in ourselves at the expense of the body of life.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just could feel when you started this sharing, this enormous amount of vitality and with the taste of creativity also in it. It's just, yeah, let's go, let's contribute, let's be in this game. It's so exciting.
It is. And we have to learn somehow, you know, like my big problem or challenge, you know, the thing that I need to learn now in my process. How can I speak? Well, how can I be? Really, it's about my own being. But when I'm in that being, somehow it will also speak through me. We're in a time in which we have this big cartoon at, you know, this President Trump cartoon, this ugly, ugly man who, I like to joke that he is the poster boy for all 10 of the 7 deadly sins. How, when we have that idea of power, that power is about fighting and power is about being angry and harsh and aggressive and making others be afraid, and that's what power is. What about love? I think love is more powerful than fear. Can we grow to where love is really able to speak with its inherent authority? Love has the authority here.
Yeah.
All that anger is childish. Love is more adult. Love is in charge. I'm working on how can I rest in a being so that the voice of love speaks calmly, maybe, maybe enthusiastically, maybe poetically, whatever. But when it's heard, people go, yes, I respond. That's the truth. That's authority. That helps me stand in a place where, no, my fear is not going to dictate how I respond. I'm going to be true to what's really true. So that love reasserts this whole thing is about wholeness reasserting itself amidst a crisis of fragmentation. And love, therefore, has to be able to reassert its natural dominion. The heart itself is reclaiming the human world in our lifetimes through us, through you, through me, through every one of us, and we need each other. And yet we have to also take responsibility for the whole thing ourselves. That's our heroic moment. Wow. You know. Thank you. Please give us the strength. You are so amazing, you who are the source of grace, the source of life, the source of evolution, the source of love. Flow through me into this world. Let me be given over as a vehicle for your reclaiming of wholeness and health in this crazy time of fragmentation. Use me, please. That's our prayer.
Yeah. I don't want to add anything to that. That's so powerful. Yeah.
Maybe we're at the end.
Yeah. Seems so. It's really. I resonate so much with what you shared, and I feel really deeply touched and really vital and activated and. And what I really take also with me is this soft landing. I so much like that. And I hope everyone listening to the audio, watching the video, you could also resonate with some some pictures, some knowledge, some presence. We are shared here and digged into it and really can also see the good in our situation, in our crisis. I thank you so much for contributing, Terry, for bringing your presence, your wisdom, your passion, your beautiful way of bringing the right words to express what sometimes is so difficult to express. I thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Pyria. It's been just delightful to spend this time with you. You're a beautiful, beautiful being. I can feel this wholeness radiating from your smile and from your eyes. And I hope we get a chance to meet in person.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.